Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam, which for understandable reasons is often shortened to DJ. In the New in Chess podcast, we speak with leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. DGT clocks and boards are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today, my guest is Matthew Sadler. Matthew is a grandmaster and a two-time British champion, but he's also a successful chess author, streamer, and an expert in chess engines. His book, Game Changer, co-authored with Natasha Regan, on AlphaZero's groundbreaking chess strategies and the promise of AI, is one of the most successful and talked about books of the past years. Not surprisingly, it won both the ECF and FIDE Book of the Year awards. Matthew is no longer a professional chess player, but he remains a formidable player and has been described as the strongest amateur in the world. So there's an awful lot we could talk about, but what I would like to speak about with Matthew today is his work and his experience as a book reviewer, his views on books written by others. The simple reason why I'd like to do that is that Matthew has been the book reviewer of New in Chess since 2013, and that his Sadler on Books columns are among the most popular articles in the magazine. Matthew, hello. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. Really nice to chat about books.
Always a good plan. So we are going to speak about books, but first I'd like to give our listeners a bit more background. In the FIDE rating list, you are no longer listed as an active player, but the last rating they provide is 2694, which is not your everyday amateur rating, to put it mildly. So could you tell us what kind of work you're doing for a living these days and how often you still play chess?
Oh, right. So, well, I work as a, I guess, solution architect for a European IT company. And we do stuff for secure remote access solutions. So allowing people to work from home and access the office securely. And yeah, obviously, it was quite a good thing to be in when COVID hit, because everyone needed to work from home securely. And yeah, it's quite an important part of the company's security. So that's great fun. I really do enjoy it. I mean, I've been an IT consultant since 1999. You know, ever since I retired from chess, and it's just got more and more interesting, you know, as time has gone by. So enjoy my my job an awful lot, I have to say. And
why has it gotten more interesting?
I think it's a couple of things. First of all, as you get better at stuff, you know, it gets the complexity increases, and that gets more and more interesting, more and more like a chess game in actual fact. And also, you know, IT, when I came into IT in 1999, it was very immature, pretty childish profession, which was handy, you know, because to start with. But it's got more and more professional. I mean, the security threats nowadays are more and more serious. And yeah, you know, professionalism is more and more important and more rewarding. So it's just turned into, you know, your average IT professional nowadays. It's, you know, the level's gone up, basically. So it's just a very interesting profession. And it's very similar to chess in the fact that there's a huge amount of information, and you have to, you know, really keep up with it. Otherwise, you fall behind very quickly. So, yeah, I mean, from that point of view, quite a few parallels with chess, you know.
Yeah, and some really deep problems that have to be solved.
Yeah, I mean, none of it, you know, I'm not... you know, if you're looking at, you know, what sort of level are you at IT? I mean, I'm you know, probably 2200, 2300, right? You know, it's not a grandmaster level IT, but of course you're dealing with IT problems that are, the IT problems themselves are not that complicated, but it's in a human context with thousands of users and all sorts of different requirements, and users who manage to make things go wrong, you know, however impossible that should be. So that's where the complexity tends to come from, you know. Also, yeah, realizing projects when you've got, you know, lots of different stakeholders and requirements to deal with, you know, that's also complex in some human way as well. So you know, that's it's good. It's really good. And as I said, the better I get at it, the more interesting the work becomes. So hopefully that's going to carry on for quite a while.
So how much time does that leave you for playing chess?
There's always nights, you know, and and that sort of stuff. Yeah, not that much time for playing chess. I mean, I haven't really played chess, you know, over the board since COVID. And, you know, the reason for that is that, you know, until COVID struck, I was in some sort of rhythm for working at chess and working at chess for playing. You know, you do your preparation, you're looking at recent games, and it's just very natural and it's in your rhythm. And then COVID came and actually the whole rhythm disappeared completely, you know, I somehow your mind fills with other stuff. I got into different aspects, and then when the lockdown stopped, I somehow never recovered my rhythm again for doing that. Actually, there's a parallel with my brother, because my brother's a concert pianist, and he's in IT as well, but he was concert pianist when he was younger, and he was giving lots of concerts still, you know, big stuff, concertos, piano concertos, all that stuff. COVID struck, all his concerts ended, and somehow, you know, you just never got back into the rhythm afterwards. I mean, it's easier for me, I think, to get back into it because, you know, obviously chess doesn't have a physical aspect at all. So I could start up again, but I don't know when or if I ever will somehow. It's there's so many other fascinating aspects to chess, you know. Reading books, writing books, doing content, all that stuff. And I'm just really enjoying that.
Yeah. Well, you've been reviewing books. And I think that if you're a book reviewer, then it's safe to assume that you're a book person. Did you grow up in a household where you were surrounded by books? What kind of role did they play?
Yeah, I mean, my parents were very, very keen on books in general. And actually still, if you go to their house, you're just finding, bookcases full of old books and encyclopedias and all the stuff you could search up on the internet. You know, they've still got all that. So books were always really important. And chess books were really, really important to me as a child. But, you know, it was really such a different era. I mean, there was really a starvation of information, you know, you compare to now, you know. I can see chess being played over the board, you know, anytime I want, any course I want, you know. But in those days, you know, the 1980s, when I was growing up, you know, if you wanted to stay connected with chess, and I very much wanted to, you know, to stay in touch with something that I love so much, then reading books was the only way that you were going to do it. And, you know, when I was young, I read uncritically. I just absorbed everything that I read without questioning it. You know, I was just simply wanted to be involved with chess and connected to chess. I just read a vast number of books. I mean, I don't know how much I picked up from that, how many good things I picked up with that and how many bad things. I think that was probably in equal measure, considering, you know, the quality of the books around that time, which was very variable. But certainly, I mean, it gives you a good breadth of, it broadens your frame of reference for chess games. And that's really where, you know, my love for old players, classic games, especially, the very early 1900s, 1900, 1910, 1920. That's really where it all developed, because, all my books were really, especially looking at that period.
Yeah. But was it mainly chess books, or were you also a voracious reader in other areas?
I was reading lots as well when I was a child. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of photos of me when I was 8 or 9, just, you know, with some sort of books and all of that. So I think it was all over the place. And certainly when I was a chess professional, you know, I was always taking lots of novels with me to read. You know, it was that was always a pretty big part to it. I mean, in all fairness, I came to the digital revolution very, very late. You know, I got my first computer for chess. You know, when I was in about 1998, 1999, and when I started in IT, I knew virtually nothing about it. You know, so I was really very, very analog. You know, even in my youth there. So you know, sort of in the second part of my career that I've really gone bananas on IT.
Yeah, But while we're talking about the other books, were you the kind of kid that was reading ahead of his age, or?
Apparently, I was. I was a good reader. You know, I was. I could read very, very early, and all of that. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, at some stage you can read, and then you just carry on. Really, you know, it's. I had. I know my parents had this. They bought this series. You know, the world's most famous books, and you know, you had all of them, all the Dickens, Wilkie Collins, Jane Austen, all those sort of things. Oh, yeah. I read all of those, you know, and it was a very nice series, you know, with with an explanation about the book and all of that. And yeah, I mean, I had my favourite authors as well. Lots of Agatha Christie, I'm afraid. That was all these murder mysteries. That was I was very, very keen on that as well. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, mixture. It's but yeah, I mean, you know, reading was always a part of my a part of my life somehow.
Well, you were bilingual. Did you also read a lot of French books?
Or yeah, French was beautiful. That was that's the biggest pleasure. I mean, French poetry was really something that I really loved. And actually, when I was playing professionally, I learned an awful lot of poems just to be able to recite. You know, just
oh, really?
Going for an evening walk and then recite some poetry. So Verlaine especially and Baudelaire. You know, again, that sort of period basically. That was really the period that I absolutely loved. I mean, in art as well, and then also in chess. You know, it's that was the thing. I mean, thing about the French language is that you can read the back of a tin of soup and it still sounds like a love poem somehow. So French has always been a huge part of my life. I mean, I sound incredibly English, and I probably am, you know, much more English than French, but I wouldn't give that French part up at all. It's been really, you know, it's a source of enormous amounts of pleasure and beauty. Still, I'm still reading, you know, books in French and reading my French poetry still, you know.
Do you think that's the musical talent in you? Because you also, you lived in the Netherlands and your Dutch is perfect. I always think that people who speak the languages, that they have an ear for that, and it's connected to musical talents.
Yeah, I don't really have any musical talent. I think my brother got all of that.
He got all of it.
I love music. Growing up with a pianist in the house, you pick up so much, you know. And I'm an absolute piano music addict, really. You know, just I listen to an awful lot of that and all sorts of different things.
But your taste is also very specific, right? You're looking for unknown pianists and concertos that no one knows of, and
it's the thing is, you know, my brother, when he was quite young, he was into romantic piano music, so especially Liszt and Brahms and all these guys. And then, you know, I got into searching out all the strange names that you'd were famous at the time, but that you never really come across anymore. And you know, it's just like, and you know, the music world is actually just like the chess world from that point of view. You get a lot of biographies now of little known players. Well, it's the same with music. Lots of pianists recording, music by little known composers. You know, people like Charles Wenker and Emil von Sauer, and all these, you know, all these great pianists that also produce music, not the top rate music, but you know, wonderful music all the same. So I do love that very much. I mean, when I was living in Holland, I lived in Amersfoort in the it was called the Componistenbuurt.
Oh, really?
And that was the composers' quarter. Yeah. So actually, it was all the streets had names of Dutch composers, classical composers. So I got into those as well.
Which street were you living in? Which composer?
I was living in the Peter van Androystraat, and Peter van Androy was I think he was a conductor of the, I think it was the Den Haag Symphony Orchestra, the Hague Symphony Orchestra, and he also composed one famous march or piece, which is never heard nowadays, but was famous for a while. You get just around it, you had Cornelis Dopper, who's quite a well-known Dutch composer at the time. Yeah. Henriette Bosmans, who recently was on a BBC program as a, you know, female composer. Willem Pijper was another one, very modern Dutch composer. The Andreessens had a couple of streets as well. You know, there's loads and loads of these guys. And I love I like slightly, you know, slightly unusual things and getting to grips with unusual topics and feeling that I know something unusual. You know, it's the whole richness of it all is really nice. It's a little bit unusual because I think when I was young, I was always focused on the winners. Mm-hmm. I only wanted to know about the winners. And, you know, when I was reading chess books and you had the histories of the world championships, you were saying, Lasker defeated Steinitz. Steinitz a loser.
That
sort of thing. But I think, as you know, as you become a chess player yourself, you become stronger and you start losing a lot of games. You suddenly realize that losers are not all bad. And there's a lot of good stuff in losers and the second rate and the second rank and all of that. And, you know, that's one of those life lessons that you pick up, you know, through competition, I think.
Yeah. So when you were a young chess player and exploring chess literature, then I guess you started with the winners as much as possible. Who were your heroes? What were the first books that influenced you?
Well, yeah, I mean, the one I've often mentioned is the big book. Really, I think, you know, there's always something that you have the feeling it binds you to chess somehow, and you feel it's never going to let you go. And that was Chess Secrets That I Learned from the Masters by Edward Lasker.
Yeah.
I think that gave me an emotional attachment to chess, you know, that's never left me and that will always stay with me. It was simply the descriptions of those masters, you know, woven in with some quite spectacular games, you know, not brilliantly annotated, but still very entertainingly annotated. All the stories, the characters and everything. It was simply amazing. And I mean, I must have had this, you know, with me as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old and just read it continually, you know. Uh-huh. And it's an absolutely beautiful book. And I mean, I think that also developed my love for that period, you know, 1818, 1900, 1900, all those great guys. That was absolutely wonderful. I mean, that's the absolute key book that I read when I was young.
You feel that was the foundation of well, not only the interest in the game, but also the story, the stories, the champions,
exactly.
The romance.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, and I would still recommend that book to absolutely anyone. I mean, I know that you know, the classic players and all that are much less interesting nowadays for younger players, but I'd still recommend that one, you know, because I think if you're a bit impressionable and you're in love with chess, then you'll love that book still, I think.
Yeah. Then probably you're also looking for books that you could learn something from, I mean, in a different manner.
Indeed. I mean, actually, funnily enough, one book that I think has had an influence on me throughout my career, it's an opening book by Ray Keane, An Opening Repertoire for White. Mm-hmm. And that actually, it's an amazingly good book, because the systems that he recommended were incredibly good, you know, very, very solid basis. So there were some, you know, the systems that he recommended against the Nimzo Indian, against the Queen's Gambit Declined, the King's Indian, the Benoni, all that stuff is stuff that I've used continually throughout my career, and I'm still playing nowadays. You know, so that was an incredible book, and it was very nicely based on classic games. So it was looking back at Botvinnik's games and showing how he played against the QGD and some Reshevsky games as well, and all of that. And it was it just fitted in very nicely with, you know, the type of games I was looking at and somehow the type of systems that I enjoyed. And you know, when I was younger, I wasn't really very theoretical at all, but books like that really got me into opening theory as well, you know, and, you know, the idea of all systems and structures that you can develop and apply later. You know, it was a very important book for me. And and also, I think, you know, objectively, a very good book. I think the other book from that point of view was Lev Poligievsky's Grandmaster Preparation. Mm-hmm. You know, that was where he talks about his own system in the Nidor, and lots of the semi-Slavs and all that. Again, that was, you know, I don't think it had an immediate influence. It was probably a bit too complicated for me when I was 10 or 11. But the idea of preparation, of working and then seeing it happen on the board, I mean, that was tremendously inspiring for me, you know, and I'm sure that's why I took up the Nidor later, you know, just, and, you know, in actual fact, Lev's conception of the Nidorf, that you didn't castle, that you played all your active move first, you know, and castle at the last moment. You know, that was, again, those were things I was applying again and again in my yeah. career. So that had a very big influence as well.
Yeah, what I loved there was the adventure, that something goes wrong in your opening and you go back to your study and you have to repair it. And I mean, I could even imagine that if you like Agatha Christie stories, then you like this one too, because there's a riddle or a problem that has to be solved, and he manages.
Yeah, I mean, I think from that point of view, you know, both Botvinnik and Polugeski, they were very powerful in conveying this idea of there being a problem and a solution, mm-hmm. you know, and that somehow, you know, that really appealed to my young mind, you know, yeah. And you know, that's really how I still view my work in that way, simply, you know, it's yeah. just, I've got a very, from that point of view, a very game tree approach to doing stuff at work, you know, but the idea of having a solution to a problem, that was a very powerful idea.
Well, I think if you're reviewing books, then, well, you have to assess their merits, and then almost automatically it will lead to some reassessment of books that you already knew. I mean, older books. Are there classics that at some point you thought, well, actually, that wasn't such a good book at all, or it was a flawed book, or the other way around, that you your appreciation only grew?
Yeah, I mean, actually a lot. I mean, I think certainly, you know, just in general, the quality of books nowadays is absolutely astonishing. I think, you know, it just it's an absolute treat, you know, seeing which books arrive and say, oh wow, you know, yeah. behind Marin's written another book on great players, or Ivan Sokolov's done another middle game analysis, you know. Yeah. I mean, those sort of things just didn't exist in my day. I mean, I think certainly looking back, I mean, at some stage somebody re-released Steinitz's Modern Chess Instructor, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, I was reading it again and thinking, oh my god, but this is awful. Yeah. Awful, you know. Yeah. Just I can't believe that anyone would ever get you know, instructed by that, you know, whereas yeah. You know, I think, you know, if you'd asked me as a child, you know, Steinitz, you know, I'd say, yeah, you know, Steinitz, yeah. really, really fantastic. And by the same token, you know, I always viewed Tarash as a total loser, because yeah. he got crushed by Lasker. But I've been reading through some of his books recently. There's a beginner's one, and also some of his annotations of his matches that he played, you know, against Marshall and all these. And these are yeah. really good. They yeah. are so good. You know, a real attempt, you know, that you never see in Steinitz everywhere, to really understand the position, you know, not just have some theories or some weird ideas or whatever, but really get to grips with the position. And, you know, some of it's wrong and some of it's incorrect and all of that. But you understand the, you know, the intelligence behind it. And the beginner's book is superb, actually. Yeah. I mean, I was really, really impressed by some of the insights in there. And I mean, also, you know, when I was young, I read Irving Chernev's book on Capablanca's chess endgames, you mm-hmm. know, and that was, somehow that made me a huge Capablanca fan, you know, mm-hmm. And I still think that's an absolutely wonderful book. Yeah? But then I read Capablanca's Chess Fundamentals recently. Yeah. And again, I was desperately disappointed, you mm-hmm. know, in the quality of insights there. And you know, Botvinnik said that he read this book and that he understood it, made him understand chess. But I'm sorry, I can't see it at all. And I've read it, you know, yeah. two or three times, but it doesn't mean a thing to me. And I think also, you know, I think a couple of books that that in retrospect I'm kind of disappointed with. There was Smyslov's Best Games, mm-hmm. 125 selected games. I had that yep. hardcover Pergamon book, and yep. And also Karpov's Best Games. There was My Best Games by Karpov, an RHM Press publication, which was really nice. I mean, I read them continually, but you know, it's really interesting, yeah, because if you ask Sergei Tivyakov about it, he'd say those are the two best books you could ever have. They tell you everything you need to learn about chess. And I think that's really a very good illustration about style, because mm-hmm. I guess that for Sergei, the stuff that he understands intuitively That's not explained by Karpov and Smyslov, and the stuff that he thinks is advanced, that's explained. But for me, being a completely different type of player to Sergei, all the stuff that I don't understand, Karpov and Smyslov don't explain it at all. It's all too obvious for them, and I'm just looking at it and thinking, I don't understand, you know.
So what was it that
they do say is stuff that I'm not really interested in. So, you know, fantastic games, of course, you know, wonderful games, but I don't really get that much from those books.
What were you mainly missing there? What were you mainly missing from Smyslov's book? Simply,
he does stuff, and I don't understand why he's doing it. You know, and it seems to me that he's playing slowly, and somehow I think, well, the opponent just made a mistake there. You know, and I don't understand why the opponent made that mistake. You know, it doesn't. I just don't understand the sense or the flow of the games from their comments, you know, and there's something obviously that doesn't fit my mindset, and they're not explaining the stuff that I would need to know.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, you know, for somebody like Sergei, probably he understands, you know, the Karpov and the Smyslov mindset much, much better.
Yeah.
And, you know, the moves they're playing, the flow is a lot more obvious to him. You know, it's, but I think that's something that, you know, that happens, happens a lot, you know, for amateurs reading books as well. And I think that sometimes you connect with an author and the places where he's explaining stuff that fits perfectly. And another player will look at it and say, yeah, but all the stuff I need to know, he's not explaining at all. You know, it's that's one of the challenges of being an author, you know, really pitching it right and really judging what your audience needs to know and what you shouldn't trouble them with.
Is that something that plays an important role, that the style of a player, that some of them are just so difficult to explain to an amateur player, like someone like Karpov? I mean, how are you going to explain that?
I mean, Mihai Marin actually did a wonderful, he did some, was it The Legends of Chess? He did, there was some big hardback book, you know, and, or maybe it was one of those, one of his DVD series. It was, but he was showing a game of Karpov against Stein. And, Karpov ended up just moving his queen, you know, it was something like queen d2, d3, b3, c3, d2, or something like that in five consecutive moves.
Yeah.
And then, Marin said, and now he's better. And Marin was sort of saying, yeah, but it's very hard to explain what on earth this has all been about, you know, but he's better. And Karpov's annotations don't really give a clue as to what on earth was happening at that moment. But, it's stylistic. Sometimes, you know, you feel a player intuitively and sometimes you simply don't. And then the explanations, are very, very important. And sometimes, as I said, for me, Karpov's annotations, Smyslov's annotations, I just don't connect with them at all, you know. Just to be clear, I acknowledge they are magnificent players.
Sure.
So I'm not criticizing their play, but just for me, annotations are not good at all.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that you've always been a reader, and for your column, well, you literally read, well, hundreds of books. Well, let's say for many people these days, reading one book is a challenge. How much time do you spend on a book? I mean, how are you a quick reader, or are you a systematic reader? How do you consume them? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in principle a very quick reader. I mean, in general, everything that I get, I take a glance at. That's always, you know, you get a quick first impression just by, you know, looking at the contents. Obviously, there's always some books where, you know, where you're sort of triggered and, oh, I'm pretty sure I'm going to like that. You know, it can be certainly, you know, for me, typical things are biographies of old players. I always think, oh, I'm interested in that. I've got some authors that I'm always, you know, quite keen on. Well, I've mentioned, Mihai Marin and Ivan Sokolov. I think they, you know, they always write incredibly interesting books. Always know that I'm going to learn something personally from that. And also, you know, always, you're always interested in if some new publisher comes along. You know, I mean, Zenon Franco sent me a couple of books from his own publishing company, one of which was about Reshevsky, you know, but you're thinking, oh, you know, I hadn't heard of this publishing company before. Let's have a look at it, you know. So that's always interesting. But you try and give, you know, all the books that you have in front of you a fair read. And then, you know, I mean, I always read, when I'm reviewing books, I've always read through them twice. because you always have your first impression, but I have noticed that, you know, if you're tired, maybe after work, or if you're grumpy or whatever, it really does affect, you know, what you think of a book. I mean, often I've read a book through once and thought, well, I'm not really sure I get this at all. Then you read it a second time, you think, I don't know what I was thinking. That's a really great book, you know. So always try and read the books twice. And I mean, what I do try and focus on, you know, with the New in Chess column is, I really only review books that I really, really like, you know, because there are so many good books out there. There's not much point really in spending time criticizing books, you know, that aren't good. I mean, maybe the slight exception to that is if, you know, if I haven't maybe liked a book very much, but it did make me think a lot and, you know, triggered a lot of thoughts, then I will, you know, review that one and try and be as, you know, as fair as possible, because, you know, it can be one of those things. It doesn't appeal to me, but if it's been that thought provoking, it must have some good quality to it. I don't have a particular plan when I'm reading through books, but I think I'm still, you know, really connected to chess. You know, I'm still really involved in chess somehow. So, you know, when I'm reading books, you know, automatically I'm getting all sorts of thoughts, you know, about, you know, patterns that I'm recognizing, or thoughts or things related to my chess career. And then hopefully, you know, when I come to write it, I've got lots of, you know, lots of ideas, and I can work that up into a column, really, you know. And but it's not very difficult to, you know, to get enthusiastic about the books, because, yeah, as I said, the quality nowadays and the breadth of it, you know, is just so many different topics, and people are writing about so much and sharing so much, you know, brilliant information. Yeah. It's really...
I was always really amazed that it took so long before people started to realize that, because at some point I had this series where I asked, well-known or famous players for their favorite chess books. And they were always naming the same books, and they were always the old books, really old books. And then I thought, aren't you reading any of the contemporary books? Because actually, these days, books are so much better than they were. And I was really surprised how long it took them to realize that. And some probably still don't realize that.
Yeah, I mean... it's a very grandmasterly thing somehow, to sort of you see it also in the attitude towards engines somehow as well, that you want to sort of feel that you know it all, and that you don't really need to read a book in order to know any more, you know. And I think that's there's some sort of, you know, pride or in there that stops you from doing it. I'm saying that because that certainly happened with me, you know, when I was a chess professional. I was often sort of thinking, well, I don't need to read that. I should know it myself somehow. But I think nowadays, you know, you're seeing Geary writing courses on the Neidorf and the French, and he's going to do a Grünfeld one. I mean, you can't ignore this, right? If Schwidler writes and does a whole course on the Grünfeld, you've got to have a look at it. You know, it's, I mean, really elite players are writing books nowadays and revealing a lot of secrets as well. It's not like in the 1980s where, players would write books and put in mistakes on purpose.
Catch
out their opponents. You know, I mean, it's just super high quality. You know, it's
That's a nice reminder, Matthew. That, because these days that would be simply impossible, but it really happened. I mean, there are famous cases of, well, people inserting mistakes in their analysis, and people and, well, opponents falling for that, which it's a good story, but that's simply no longer possible.
No, I mean, you know, just the quality of it, and I think, you know, also, I mean, the elite players, it's a matter of pride, right? That they're going to produce the best thing possible as well. You know, it's changed somehow. I mean, I think, in the 1980s when I was growing up, there were some authors, you know, who took enormous pride in writing a book, and that was like a magnum opus. I mean, I think Lev Poligievsky and his Grandmaster Preparation, that was something like that. But I think there were also a lot of authors who saw it as something, you know, quick and dirty less than playing chess somehow, you know. And I think that's turned around completely. I mean, you know, producing chess books, courses, content in general, you know, it's much more important, much more respectable, you know. And I think that's only right. You know, I think that's a really positive thing, because that's how you that's how you connect with the rest of the chess community. You know, it's much more so than just playing over the board.
Yeah. Well, the question often is, especially with the emphasis on improvement these days and training, what does a book bring you? And then there's, you already said you love old biographies and the lives of players, history. Where do you see the use of that? I mean, does it have an intrinsic use, or is it just, the luxury that you have to have some extra information? How do you assess it in the growth of a player? Does it play a role?
Yeah, that's a really fun question, actually, because I've thought about it a lot, you know, because somehow, you know, intuitively, you look at yourself always when you're thinking, how should young players improve? And what you went through was you grew up in a scarcity of information, but you read lots of books. Lots of them were wrong and had wrong information, and sometimes horrifically bad information. But you got past that, and as you got stronger and stronger, you realized that some of that information was wrong, and you corrected it in your mind. And eventually you've ended up, and I became a grandmaster, quite a strong one. So that must be the way that everyone should improve. Eh? That's what you sort of feel intuitively. But then suddenly I started wondering about it, because if I look at how I think about positions and just reflect on how I'm thinking, then there's so many things. What you realize is that the thing that really sticks in your mind is the stuff that you first learned when you were young. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of positions where I think the first thing that I remembered from a book when I was eight, and then suddenly I do a little flip in my head and I say, oh, no, I know that's not good anymore. Yeah. I've corrected that. I know now that this is better. Mm-hmm. And when you think about that, you sort of think, that isn't that tremendously inefficient, and isn't that tremendously harmful? And, when I look at the quality of my intuition, for example, what's the first few moves that I see in a position, I think actually that it's actually not that good at all, relatively speaking. You know, I compare it to the first five moves I think are good in the position to what an engine thinks is good in a position, and I'm not really doing very well, I always view it like... if you look at the edifice of your mind, the chess knowledge that you've built up, and you look at it like a building, you'd really want it to be like a beautifully well-proportioned cathedral, with solid foundations. But having learned the way I did, learned lots of wrong stuff and then corrected it, it's actually some sort of incredibly fragile and wonky structure, that's just got lots of dead ends and repairs and all of that, Actually, I think that young players should not learn, certainly from the books that I read when I was young, because there's lots of high quality material on recent games that's out there. I mean, the books of Jakob Argaard are the perfect example of that. Incredibly detailed analysis of absolutely correct positions, engine analyzed, engine checked. What that means is, it's not that the young player will get all of the richness and complexity of the position straight away, but the model that'll stick in his head the first time that he learns something will be a correct one, and as he gets better, the complexity that he detects in the position will also be correct as well. I always remember, I can't remember the position now, but there was something about it. I saw in an old book, they said, oh, this position is all about dark square weaknesses. But later when I became stronger, you sort of thought, I was thinking back to the position and thinking, but it's not about dark square weaknesses, because, if I just moved one knight from g7 to f7, those dark, it's black's better, not lost anymore. It was all about the combination. It was the dark squares plus misplaced pieces, plus the fact that your king was there and that, white had some other piece configuration. It's so much more complex. But you're drawing, bad conclusions only from what you see at first sight in the position and not what's behind it, And I think, with proper quality training material, you just learn the correct examples, and as you get stronger, that those same examples are still valuable for you.
But how much
bigger?
Yeah, how much basic knowledge should you have to appreciate that? I mean, to be open to that kind of training or to that kind of training material, you.
I think you start. You just start from beginner level.
Oh, really?
Just with good training material, you know? And as you get better, you discover more and more in it. But the thing is that the thing that you always remember the best is what you first saw when you were you were young, and if you saw stuff that was actually in general wrong, then that has a knock-on effect for the rest of your the rest of your career, I feel. I feel lots of my weaknesses in my play, a lot of them are due to that, basically. You know, and I've corrected it as I've got stronger.
Yeah.
But so much of what I think of first of all in a position is that wrong thing that I've thought of first of all.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. With the DGT electronic chessboard, millions of chess lovers can follow chess tournaments live. At-home chess fans use the boards to play online or play against chess computers with the same boards that top players use in tournaments all over the world. Play like a pro with a DGT board.
Well, it takes us to another problem that you wrestled with or what you wrote about when you were enjoying a book on, I think it was on Rubinstein. You think, okay, I'm enjoying this so much, but at the same time you realize that some of the ways he was looking at positions was wrong, that there were wrong assessments, and then you think, to what extent is this useful for a youthful player?
Not at all useful.
But still, you wouldn't like to keep them away from a Rubinstein book. I mean, so what?
No. Yeah, it's a tough one, right? Yeah. Because the point is, it means all those books about all the, you know, the biographies of old players, and even the books, you know, this one was by Razuvayev about.
Rubinstein. Yeah.
That's the. They mean a lot to me because that's what I grew up with. I've got this enormous nostalgic feeling. I feel young again when I'm seeing that. Of course, you know, if a young player hasn't grown up with it, what does it mean somehow? Maybe, you know, maybe not that much. I mean, I must say that one of the best exercises I ever did was when I came back to chess after being away for so long. And I picked up Alekhine's Best Games, and, you know, a lot of annotations by Alekhine in there. And I just said, OK, well, I'm going to read it critically. I'm not going to read it like I used to when I was little. I'm going to read it critically and try and find mistakes. And that was an incredibly powerful training, I have to say, because, you know, in modern books, you can just sort of read through it and say, well, I'm sure all those variations are complicated, but they're all good because it's all been engine checked. Whereas here, you know, you're being sharp. You're really being challenged to read actively and find mistakes. And actually, in the case of Alekhine, I both found mistakes, which, you know, I did a lot of analysis on my blog at the time. But I was also quite impressed, actually, I have to say, with the quality of his analysis and what he was doing. Yeah. He was a serious guy, this Alekhine, I have to say. So that was really nice as well, you know. But I think that's a really superb training to, you know, to read old books critically and try and find mistakes as well. I mean, I will say that I think, you know, the value of old games is still maybe, you know, in the modern era is that a lot of people are just not looking at them. So if you actually spend some time looking at them, you've probably got some frames of reference that you know, that players who are totally focused on the modern game won't have. And I mean, there are a lot of patterns that you see in the old games, you know, that that come back in modern human chess as well. So that there's always some value to it. But I think, you know, sort of you've got to be very, very careful with following old books, because you know, often very categorical in their statements about what's good and what isn't, and often completely wrong. I mean, you know, this book about Razuvayev and Rubinstein, it was written in a very nice way, and I like the book enormously, but I mean, a whole scala of dynamics were missing from it, basically. Yeah. You know, the engines were saying, yeah, but come on, I can sacrifice the exchange in this position, and black's fine, or a pawn, or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, Razuvayev was kind of saying, oh, well, you know, white wins a pawn, and this is winning. And yeah. You know, the engine's just going way further with, you know, particularly with dynamic assessments. And I think that's what you really miss, especially in the...
We shouldn't forget that, in fact, the book was, 30 or 40 years old, 30 years old.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, yeah. I was a professional in the pre-computer age. I know how tough it was to analyze. I mean, I barely dare to look at my own games from that period, and certainly my own analysis from that period. You know, I mean, I'm really worried if somebody was to take a good computer look at them. Yeah. I wouldn't like to see what the results are. You know, and I tried very seriously to analyze well, but. You notice how many tactical mistakes you make just to start with, quite apart from the positional ones. You know, it's quite scary. And, you know, I think that's also the point that, you know, your conception of chess that you got from those books in the 1980s and from old games is outdated. You know, it's good enough, funnily enough, you know, up to a certain point, maybe even 26, 70, 80, 90. Yeah. But at the elite level, it's completely lacking.
You're famous for your enthusiasm. I remember when you started writing the column, then at some point there were letters or requests. Could we do with a few fewer exclamation marks? And at some point you reduced the number of exclamation marks. At the same time, I thought it was so much part of your style. Another thing was that, well, also friends of yours, they would say, well, there's so many 5-star books there. Couldn't there be a bit fewer? Did you ever regret giving 5 stars to books and thought, well, maybe that was a bit too enthusiastic?
Yeah. I mean, I find the star system so difficult, you know, because it's so hard to be objective, really. You know,
Matthew, I have to interrupt you now because you said something earlier when you were describing you were describing yourself the level of your IT level, and you said, oh, okay, I'm 20 to 30, and then I was thinking briefly that we have this essentially stupid 1 to 5. Star system. Why not give it ratings? You have so much more flexibility, and a chess player.
That's true, actually, that's actually a very nice. It's actually a very nice idea. I have to say, it's. I mean, I did try for a while to with 4.5 stars and stuff like that, but I got called back on that. That was not good. Yeah, it's just very.
Actually, the ELO system could be used in so many more instances. I mean, when I go to a museum and I try to explain to someone how good a painter is, I'll just give them a rating. And you could do it with books probably as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's only chess players would understand it, though, I think. But
that's true.
Idea. Yeah, it's a lovely idea. This rating system is quite tough. No, I mean, sometimes I sort of, I do it 1 month and I say, oh, these are all 5-star. And I come to the next month, I think, oh, God, these books are even better, you know, and I've already given out 5 stars before. It's, the point is that there are, you know, there are just so many, you know, good books out there. And it's sort of hard to, between 4 and 5 is always quite tricky. I should probably be, you know, more discerning and really only save my 5s for the absolute, absolute amazing books, like Paul van der Sterren.
That's what I wanted to bring up. I mean, that was one of your... most recent 5 stars, Paul van der Sterren's In Black and White. And you even wrote, I think this is simply the finest chess book I've ever read. What made you come to that conclusion? Because that's quite something if you've read so many books.
Yeah, no, actually, I can even get quite emotional talking about that book because, you know, that there was being a professional in the old days, that was something quite special, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably people...
Maybe we should briefly tell the listeners who may not know the book what kind of book it is.
Oh, yeah. That's good. So this is it's an autobiography by Paul van der Sterren, a very strong Dutch grandmaster. Who was, I guess, you know, below the level of the very top grandmasters like, you know, Jan Timman and Jeroen Piquet and Luc Van Vele. But, you know, an extremely strong player. And he had a period in his life where he suddenly exploded and become, you know, and got unbelievably good results. Really, you know, everything that he had in himself came out, and he got through the candidates, and he played a fantastic match against Gatakamski, it was really really incredible, pinnacle of his career, and a pinnacle of which, you know, I would have been enormously proud if I'd managed to achieve that in my career. So and for the rest, he was a strong grandmaster, and you know, got some very good results, some less good results, and the book describes that whole whole arc of his career, basically. So I mean, that would, you know, that would always be interesting. It's always interesting to read about that. But what amazed me about the book was there was so many, you know, just that there was incredible human perspective to it, and so many things that that don't make sense in a chess career that you live with, you know, they came out in what he was writing. And I think, you know, again, it's important just to make the difference between how chess was in those days, the pre-computer age, and how it is now, because you spend all of your career in complete uncertainty about chess technical matters. You know, you could analyze a position, a sharp knight, or for 2 weeks, and believe me, I've done that many times, and at the end not know at all, not be much wiser as to the objective evaluation of the position. You'd have lots of ideas, you'd have lots of variations, but were they right? You didn't know. You played a game, you did not know, unless you put aside, you know, a week of analysis, exactly whether you'd really been better or worse, or whether you'd made mistakes or not. Yeah. And so you're constantly in that operating in a fog of uncertainty, you know, when you're playing chess. And I mean, you see the effects of that are quite profound, whereas nowadays, you know, within 1 second you can know what happened in the game. Was I better, was I worse? You know, you do some preparation for somebody, within 10 seconds you've got a line at least, you know, what you're going to do. It's so different. And that old way of that old professional career was, you know, incredibly romantic, but also, you know, incredibly uncertain and very stressful, but also delivered some amazingly beautiful things. And so many of, you know, Paul somehow managed to describe, you know, that uncertainty. And, you know, there were so many moments where he said, and I was in good form and I didn't really understand why. I could think of several reasons, but on the other hand, those reasons came about again later in my career and I wasn't playing that well either.
Yeah.
And all those things, it was just sentence after sentence was just, for me, you know, a feast of recognition. And it really, you know, brought tears to my eyes somehow, because it was described, that was exactly it. That was why it was so beautiful. That was why it was so amazing, you know, to be a professional in those days. And one of the things, that, I mean, I mentioned it in the book review, and he mentioned that he played a game in the Dutch league, and it was against a not very strong player, and he won it, but he was so happy with it, and it, you know, he was somehow for a week afterwards he was pleased, and he remembers it still, and it was great. And I've had that experience, you know, so often. When I came back playing chess, you know, so I'd play a game at the weekend for Amersfoort in the Dutch league, I was playing people, you know, 400 500 points weaker than me, but, you know, I played a good game. The whole week I was singing at work, you know, just so happy. And you're thinking, why? But it's something above the result somehow. And the opponent, it's, you know, you feel like you've connected with chess, that somehow you understood the game, and the game spoke to you somehow, you know, just really strange feeling. But, you know, I've never heard those feelings described by any other player. You know, some players have given, you know, very open accounts of their career and, you know, being honest about disappointments and all that. But yeah, it's more than that. You know, it's a real human experience. And that's what Paul brought across so beautifully. Yeah. Quite apart from the fact that, you know, he's a lovely guy and he comes across as a lovely guy. And you know, you really want him to do well. You know, once you're reading the book, you really want everything to go well. And you see the blunders that he made. You know, he was tactically vulnerable. That was always one of his one of the things during his career. And you desperately want him to see that move. You know, it's really it's an amazing book. You know,
and, yeah, it has this overwhelming honesty and in such detail that. Well, occasionally, I mean, not occasionally, quite often you think, maybe you shouldn't have written this. I mean, don't be too honest because you make yourself so vulnerable. And it's all there.
Yeah.
It's just all there.
It's all there. And it's, you know, it's not, he was a relatively normal guy having a normal life, but having, you know, wonderful adventures in the chess world. And it's just, I mean, I really, you know, I can only say to everyone that you should absolutely read it. And I think I also have to mention that, you know, mentioned it in the book review as well, but it's well worth mentioning that I thought the translation by Peter Buhl was really outstanding because it's so important that book flows, you know, the prose flows really well. And for me, the prose was beautiful. It was, it was really incredible. And I just thought I thought that was really, really well done as well. It was brilliant from start to finish. And what I also really liked was, that Paul didn't go back and go with an engine through all his analysis time. Yeah. He left as it was, because what you really notice in that is that, you know, you read it and none of this, you know, of course, there are probably tactical mistakes in there and all that, but all of what he's saying makes sense. It's all good judgment and everything. It's just simply that, that's how we were at the time. Very good players, but also missing a part of the game that the engines have revealed, you know, but it makes perfect sense and it fitted perfectly with the story. So I thought it was just perfectly done, you know, all the way through. And I can really recommend it to everyone, you know, I think even young players, you know, would benefit just from seeing that and reading it.
Because it also teaches you a lot about the psychology of the game, the richness of the game in a human sense, and a lot. It's that's what comes to mind all the time if you think of the book, how rich it is and how much there is. Suppose that this is one of your desert island books, Matthew, and you're allowed to take two or four more. Which ones would you take?
Ooh, that's a very good question. I'd like to surround myself with biographies of players, actually. And I'll definitely take something by Mihai Marin. I think it's Legends of the Games.
Okay.
Legends of the Game, where he does he focuses on little facets of great players. You know, I think it was Fischer's light squared bishop endings and that sort of thing, because I think that's that's really so rich. I think also, to be honest, his book on Bent Larsen as well was absolutely brilliant as well. Mm-hmm. I think you could lose yourself in that one for forever. I would also I'd take, you know, something I've mentioned again by Ivan Sokolov, one of his middle game books, somehow to have something lovely and complex and to understand. I mean, probably if I have got a lot of time to kill, I'd probably take one of Jakob Argaard's books.
Yeah.
One of his books that he's written with Gelfand, maybe the one on Rook Endgames. I know that that would last me a very, very long time. I mean, they're incredible books, but
How do you read those, Matthew? Do you take out a board, or do you play on the computer, or do you do a lot by head, or
they cost me those. That's the problem. I haven't actually reviewed as many of those books as I would like, because I can't, you know, it's, you know, you sort of like to say, well, I'm pretty sure it's a masterpiece, so
yeah.
So off we go. But I can't do that simply.
Yeah.
So I've often spent a lot of time, you know, analyzing it, and then running lots of engine games, and just to look at the conclusions and all that. They're very difficult to review, put it that way. You know, I mean, they're just wonderful books, but they're just. But in order to say something really, really good about them and proper about them, you've got to give them the proper time and attention, and that's quite. That's quite tricky somehow. I do feel bad about it. I haven't, you know, reviewed more of those books, but I really do try and do a sensible job of it. I mean, you know, in principle, they are really superb. You've got to be clear about that. So definitely take one of those with me, I think. What else? I'm having a look at.
I think we have a handful now, and of course, we are missing many. That's inevitable. But I also wanted to ask you about how do you see the future of chess literature? I mean, you've written great books about the impact of the second generation engines like AlphaZero. But while doing so, you also must have been confronted by the difficulty of putting all these findings on paper in an accessible manner. Do we need a new format of book for this?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think everything is starting to go in the right direction, actually, because I think, you know, you are starting to realize that probably chess books are too complicated.
Yeah.
You know, and that...
this is just what I want to say in between. I mean, I think that was the brilliant thing about Game Changer, that you managed to present something so incredibly difficult in a very accessible manner. I mean, modern classic that you cannot review, but I would definitely recommend to everyone.
I think that Natasha had a very big part in that, because we were constantly
in the way the material was presented, you mean.
You know, and Natasha was very, very, very good at saying, yeah, but you know, this is not this is too complex. You put a game within a game. You know, I'm getting lost reading it. You know, simplify it. And she was also vicious in taking out all my exclamation marks as well. That was, I think that was a very good working partnership for that book there, because I think that really helped make everything concise and simpler somehow. You know, when it was in principle quite a complicated and a very new subject at the time. You know.
Yeah.
I think that in general books are have been too complicated somehow, and I think one of the things I was really impressed with, I mentioned it a few times in my reviews, but that the way that chessable courses are being transferred to books, and then you look at the books and you say, that's actually a very nice level of complexity. Because in a course there's a limit to how many variations you can show when you're doing a video, so you tend to be much more selective and choose much more carefully, and when that goes into book form, that's very, very nice indeed. You know, I think that's a very good level of average complexity that a whole scala of players can deal with. It's even very pleasant for strong players to read as well, I think, your eyes aren't glazing over as you as you look at variations somehow. So but I think that strange enough, in the engine world, less complex books is definitely where it's going to go to, and I think that's a very positive idea. I think the whole trend, and I hope that continues for a long time, of looking at lesser known players, all the opportunities for research that you have for finding all these games and sources, that keeps on going. I mean, that's. And with all, with a lot of new players streaming in, because of COVID and the Queen's Gambit and all that, I do think it's important. Not all of them will be interested in the history of chess, but you do want people, to have that sense of that's what makes it so amazing as well. The idea that you can compare your ideas that you play now to something that somebody played 150 years ago. That really is. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's not many. things that you can get into where you can feel that direct connection over history, where you can feel that you're part of something. I think that's very, very important as well. Apart from that, I think, more books about, we could do with some more books about psychology of chess, how it feels to play chess. And maybe also, you'd say, not only from a male perspective, but also from a female perspective as well. I think what we're really missing is, biographies of great female players as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would pay very good money to read a biography of Nonaga Prendashvili, for example. Mm-hmm. Incredible career, long career, and would be amazing to know to read about that. But I think there's plenty of areas like that that could improve. But I think psychology of chess is also not as explored as it could be, and also for improving players, for strong players, for there's definitely quite a bit to do with that. If anyone can ever come up with a killer way of making it easier to learn openings, then that would be absolutely.
Oh well, no, that would spoil the fun, Matthew.
We need to keep on selling more and more courses. But there's so many topics I think that are still
If you had to choose one, tons of books have been written and. We have the feeling that there's always room for more, but let's say if you could end with a final wish, which one book should be written quite soon, urgently?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'll go for my biography of Gaprindashvili. I think that's
Nonaga Prindashvili.
That would be a really good one. I mean, we did. Natasha and I did a little bit on her in Chess for Life. And it was pretty crazy stuff. And I even annotated the game of Nona's in Reengineering the Chess Classics. This absolutely bananas game against Utielki, I think his name was. There must be loads of interest. I mean, Chibodanitsa as well has had a really great career as well. Pia Kramling, still active all these years,
She's going to play in Norway chess shortly.
She's playing in Norway as well, a big contender still. I mean, it's really a lovely person as well, obviously. Look at her whole career with Juan Bellon as well, who's himself is a really, really, really interesting player, and then her daughter as a streamer and all of that.
I'm going to agree on Gaprindashvili, Matthew, because I remember when I went to the World Cup in Tbilisi and she was in the press room sitting there and she was a very dominant voice, and not only about the chess, but also when we were speaking about football, because she's a big football fan as well.
Oh, she's a big football fan as well.
She gambles. She's a many-sided person. We need that book on Nona Gaprindashvili.
Yeah, I mean, actually, if I could be allowed one more, I think just going back a long time ago, a biography of Tartakova would be amazing as well.
Yeah.
This guy had an absolutely amazing life, much tragedy as well, but also amazing, That's kind of the romantic idea. I mean, Gaprindashvili as well, somehow, it's the romantic idea of being a chess player somehow. You going into the world and just doing everything that you like and being really good at chess as well.
Tartakova. Well, there's this fictionalized biography, but we want the real one. Yeah. So, okay. Well, thank you very much, Matthew. I mean, we could easily have continued for a couple of hours, and hopefully we will do that one day. I very much enjoyed your insights and your views on chess books, and thank you for joining us.
No, thanks very much.